Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. We get that call in the middle of the night, that dreaded call, Mom's fallen, or Dad's broken a hip, or one day we just notice that Mom is a bit more confused, maybe a little bit more disheveled than she once was. And then we begin to realize that this means so much more than it appears. It's a confirmation of how vulnerable they have become as they age. And now we must step up. We must be there for them. And while the experience may be exhausting and painful, looking back, many view it as a blessing and feel fortunate to have spent time being there for their loved ones. On today's show, we're going to share stories of caring for and saying goodbye to those who have cared for us. We've got two guests, Patricia Nugent and Lewis Colbert. Patricia Nugent is the author of They Live On, Saying Goodbye to Mom and Dad. It's a collection of vignettes she wrote. They chronicle the time she spent caring for her dying parents over the course of 18 months, and she joins us by phone from her home in upstate New York. Pat, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dan. It's a privilege to be on the air with you.
Thank you. And Lewis Colbert is director of the Delaware County Office of Services for Aging. His mother passed away in the springtime, and he's written about caring for her. He also advises others how to assist aging members of their families, and he joins us right here in the studio. Lewis, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
And we'd love to hear your stories. Our number is 888-477-9499. If you have had the experience, maybe you're in the middle of the experience of caring for your aging parents, we'd like to hear from you. And if you're on the other side of 60, 65, 70, tell us how you would like to be cared for by your young ones. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Pat, let's start with you. Your book is a deeply personal and introspective journal. Why write a journal in the first place? What did it do to you, for you?
I think that one thing caregivers realize is the experience feels very lonely. You're up against not only the disease or the condition that you're dealing with your parents, but often you're up against the medical community, and you're just trying to stay afloat yourself. And so my way of dealing with what I was seeing unfold, and Dan, your introduction was perfect. You get the phone call, the broken hip, all of a sudden things are not the way they were, and again, your life gets thrown into chaos. So I journaled when I got home at night from the hospital after spending time with my parents, and I would journal just to be, for my own therapy, to try to understand why our world had come unwrapped so quickly.
Your parents, or all of our parents' demise, is one of the most predictable and unpredictable events in our lives. So your journey begins with a phone call about a broken hip. Tell us about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's probably the most private, universal story there is, because we all do something similar. But one day I had two very healthy parents in their 80s living in Florida, golfing every day, and they wintered down there. They spent the summer in Rochester, New York. And then the phone call comes through. My dad fell, broke his hip. My mother's in the emergency room with him, and she's flustered. She's not sure what kind of decisions to make. They want to put feeding tubes in him all of a sudden, and again, everything came unraveled. So I'm getting the long-distance phone calls from the Florida emergency room to New York State saying, what should I do? And I think it throws us when our parents start asking us what should they do, because we're not used to that. We're used to them having the answers or thinking they have the answers and helping us.
So that's the beginning, is that phone call about the broken hip. And that's where things begin to unwind, I guess, in all of your lives. But I'd like to back you up a little bit before that phone call. A month, a year, a decade, or two or three. Tell us about your relationship with each of your parents.
My parents were very independent, fiercely independent. I had a very strong relationship with my mom. She really was my best friend. My dad was a challenge for me. My dad had some rage, like so many of the World War II era men, fathers did. And he was not, he was a little bit more volatile. So the experience of losing, of something happening to each of them were two very different experiences for me and for them. I lived about 3 hours away, but got home probably once a month to spend time with them, and they didn't need much. They didn't want much.
I want to come back. So your relationship with your mother was a good one and a strong one.
Right.
So tell me about your dad.
My dad was he was up and down. There are times I would call home and he'd be wonderful and happy. There's other times I would call home and he'd be upset that I hadn't been home in a while. His love was more conditional than my mother's
And your relationship was more stormy.
Yes, it was definitely more stormy.
Yeah.
I was not inclined to spend time alone with him, where I would crave time alone with my mother.
Hmm.
And yet, as you know from reading the book, at the end of his life, I was so grateful to have that time to reconcile
right.
with him.
Don't give away the plot.
Okay.
We'll get to it. Please. Damn, these authors. They're impossible. All right, let's
That's
get...
That's true, by the way.
Let's get away from the author. Lewis, I want to hear from you. Pat's story started with a phone call about a broken hip. Not so much with your mother. She had dementia. Tell us when you first realized she had dementia.
Well, I thought when Pat talked about the experience being very lonely, that is such a universal kind of feeling. With my mom, it was a little different in that probably around 2003, my father passed. And I think going through that experience really took its toll on my mother. And she woke up one day and in hindsight, she was depressed and we didn't know it. We didn't know what to do. She wasn't eating. She was confused, and so the only thing we knew what to do was to take her to the emergency room. And we figure if he goes to the hospital and gets a good workup, at least we have some idea of what is going on. So that is what we did. And from there, she probably declined for about a month, and then she just kind of snapped out of it. And so, as I said, in hindsight, we realized that she was depressed at the time. But it was long into her dementia before I really began to recognize and begin to accept the fact that my mother was suffering from dementia. I think the first time it really hit me, I was in a care transition meeting with her social workers, her geriatrician, a lot of the medical people. She was in the a life at home program out in Delaware County. And they asked me what stage I thought my mother was in. And I said, well, I think my mom is mild. And they looked at me and they were just shocked. I could see the shock on their face. And they said, your mother is suffering from severe dementia. And it was like a rude awakening for me. But I think one that is very common, that whole denial that a lot of us children go through.
You said that. You said that boomers are in denial and may not see their parents decline clearly. Why is that? Or is it obvious?
I think it has so much to do with you are so used to the roles that our parents have taken care of us for so long that when you are dealing with that, especially dementia and Alzheimer's and those declines, it is so hard because it's not like a broken hip where you can have your hip repaired and you can have a walker and a cane and physical elements, you know, can be compensated. With the mental, with the dementia, it's just so much more harder.
And it's interesting to me that you didn't see it, and you're a professional. You'd been in the field for 30 years.
Not only have I been in the field, but I'm trained by the Alzheimer's Association, and I run a caregiver support group at my church. Wow. And it was right in front of my face, and I absolutely, totally missed it.
Isn't that amazing?
Really?
Isn't that amazing? It says something about us as a species, about how we are able to not see what we don't want to see. Pat, you said something very similar. You said you were woefully unprepared for your parents' end-of-life experience.
Mm-hmm. And I recently had an estate attorney ask me rhetorically, why are my clients so surprised when their parents die? He just didn't understand that. I think it's too painful to project out and to anticipate it coming. So I think we're almost always caught off guard. Even if it's a long-term terminal illness, you still have them, and then they're gone. And I was woefully unprepared, and I think most of us are, even though most of us will bear witness to our parents' final days. But they seem bigger than life us somehow.
Well, and the psychology of it is, you know, and 6-7 year olds, we know this about them, that's the first time you realize that your parents can die, and oh my God, if they can die, we can die.
Mm-hmm.
And well, we certainly can't die. I mean, that's too terrifying, but that psychology stays with us because all that understanding a 6-7 year old has goes underground.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it comes up when it has to, when you get the call or when you hear that your mom's got dementia.
Mm-hmm.
Lewis, I want to come back to you. You said you didn't feel ready. You didn't know even the mechanics of transferring your mother from her wheelchair to the commode, how to hold her up while getting her pants down. How can one prepare? I mean, you're not going to go with a healthy mom and learn how to do these transfers.
Well, I think as a system, the aging network, I think, is very complex. I think, you know, Pat talks about getting that phone call, your parents can be healthy and okay, and then next thing they're in the hospital, and in the hospital you're dealing with doctors, you're dealing with nurses, you're dealing with specialists, you're dealing with insurance companies, and then from there you get discharged quickly, and then you're in the community and you have things like the Area Agency on Aging and a variety of things. It's very complex. In my situation, it seems to me that the first time a social worker came out to assess my mom, the next logical thing should have been a physical therapist, an occupational therapist, to come out with my siblings and I and talk about all these things. You know, your mother not only has Alzheimer's, but she has Parkinson's. And these are the kinds of devices that you can use to help her stay as independent as possible. This is how you move somebody in a bed. Those kind of things that, quite frankly, it was a hospice nurse, the last month of her life, that actually showed us so many techniques that we're thinking to ourselves, why didn't we have this 4 years ago?
Why didn't you?
I don't know. I don't know.
Oh, wait, you're in the business.
I know I'm in the business.
So fix it, man, fix it.
I still don't know why, but I do know now. You know, and when a lot of times, you know, friends and colleagues, when they figure out what you do, and their parents need help, they call you. We become private care managers, and those are the things that I share with them and the things that I tell them.
I want to come back to that. We've got to take a very short break, and I want you to read a passage that you wrote in, or I'll read it to you, in February's Aging Today magazine. We're talking with Lewis Colbert, and Patricia Nugent. Lewis is director of the Delaware County Office of Services for the Aging. Pat is the author of They Live On, Strategies, Saying Goodbye to Mom and Dad. And that's what we're talking about today on Voices. We're talking about caring for our aging parents and ultimately saying goodbye. And we'll talk about what happens after that, what changes in our lives. We'd love to hear from you. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We're talking about the caregiving process at this point in our show. So please give us a call. We'd love to hear from you. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY.
The Longs Park Amphitheater Foundation supports WHYY and presents the 33rd Annual Longs Park Art and Craft Festival. This fine art and craft show will be held rain or shine this Friday through Labor Day in Lancaster's Longs Park. 200 fine artists and craftspeople have been chosen to exhibit from over 1,000 applicants. The show will feature an array of jewelry, apparel, paintings, ceramics, sculpture, and more. Advance tickets and details online at lancastercounty.com.
At the heart of everything we do at WHYY is one thing, storytelling. We try to inform, engage, inspire, and connect through deep, colorful stories. And NewsWorks Tonight brings together the best reporting from our network of journalists in one smart, lively regional news magazine. Weeknights at 6 on WHYY-FM, or listen online at WHYY.org and NewsWorks.org. There's also the podcast, and you can follow NewsWorks Tonight on Twitter and Facebook. And that's the story.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about when roles start to get reversed, when we start to care for our aging parents. What's the process like? Knowing what the end is going to look like. Our number is 888-477-9499. We're talking with Patricia Nugent and Lewis Colbert, both of whom have had their own experience of caring for their aging parents. Lewis, I'd like to read a few lines in the article you wrote in Aging Today, because you bring an interesting dimension to this that never gets talked about, and that's male caregivers. So I'll begin to read. Like so many men, the role of caregiver was hard for me to wrap my hands around. Many of us don't know how to ask for help or where to run for services. I was a caregiver for nearly 2 years before I started to think of myself as one. Then I began to incorporate self-help techniques to take better care of myself. So now, instead of telling my fellow male caregivers to take care of yourself, I say, ask for help. So first, I wonder what self-help techniques you employed.
So one of the things that I did was I had to make time for myself. So I would walk in the mornings. When I got home at night, I would walk. I had gone for a while there, and the first thing that I was cutting out was my exercise and those kind of things. So I had to incorporate that back in. I also would take my time driving home. So I would leave the office and I would be with my mom every day from 4 to 7, and my sister got home. And then I would leave there and go home and do whatever I needed to do at nighttime. I would just take my time driving home. I might stop at the ice cream store and get me some ice cream. I did things to make sure that I had time for myself. And I kept feeding myself and telling myself, I can do this. I'm strong enough. I can do this.
The most powerful part of that piece I read was the end, where you say, I tell them to ask for help. Easier said than done, huh?
But you have, but I found that you have to be repetitive with men. The literature suggests 1 in 3 men now are caregivers.
Wow.
And traditionally, you know, the research has always been geared towards the women. But the reality of it is more and more men are doing it. More husbands are doing it. More sons are doing it. And what we do know is men tend not to know resources, and they tend not to know how to ask for help. So I find, especially like in my caregiver support group, I have to repeat it every month. ask for help. How are you taking care of yourself? How are you taking care of yourself? And still, we ignore our own needs.
Yeah, it's
so
hard.
Often.
It's hard to do. Mm-hmm. How dare I care for myself when my parents suffering and need me?
Yeah. We don't talk a lot. Like in the article, I talk about that whole the personal hygiene piece with your mother and the son, which is very different than a husband taking care of their wife. You know,
sure.
And that's like the whole. That's also hard to kind of overcome.
Yeah, Pat. We talked about the transition of from being a child of a parent to being a parent of a parent. And if you have your book handy, you you wrote a beautiful piece of poetry on page 53 of your book, and it really tells about your internal life during this transition. Would you mind reading it?
I'd be happy to. If I could just say one thing about male caregivers very quickly.
Please.
I assumed wrongly that the demographic for my book would be middle-aged women, and what I have found is it's about 50-50 with men buying the book, and they often say they're buying it for their wives, but they end up reading it and getting something out of it. So I would agree with Lewis. More and more men are stepping up and assuming that caregiver role as well.
Well.
Okay, this is called the transition. The transition has begun. There is nothing for me to carry in tonight. My mother has no material needs for me to meet. I feel I have lost my purpose. In reality, I may just be finding it. From cure to care, from hope to despair, from holding on to letting go, from managing to collapsing, from my mother to a patient, from hospital to hospice. Hold her hand instead of handing her water. Hug her instead of feeding her. Feed her spirit instead of her body. For the body is leaving. The spirit will remain.
That's tough to respond to. You know, it's so poignant and raw. You know, when I commented about this, you know, it's just right out of Ecclesiastes, you know, a time for living and a time for dying. Lewis, you had a reaction to what she just read.
Well,
kind of an acknowledgement looked like.
It is, when you are on the other side of the process, you do realize, and I heard Patricia refer to it earlier, you do realize that it is probably one of the most precious opportunities as a human being that you will actually ever have.
Yeah. We've got, Lewis, how did you deal with the transition from being a child of a parent to being a parent of a parent? What was that like for you?
It was actually, quite frankly, it was very easy. Our father had died earlier, and his was so different. It was quick. Hospice came in, and to be quite honest with you, hospice was an unbelievable, tremendous treasure, and it helped us.
It's what everybody says about hospice.
It is so unbelievable. And Mom was long and drawn out. But the thing about Mom was, because it was long and drawn out, it really gave us the opportunity to say goodbye while the dementia was not severe. And she was always a very candid lady, and so we could have conversations, and she wasn't afraid of death, and she wasn't afraid of, you know, life after on this earth. So it made it very easy in so many situations.
I feel a little bit guilty. I gave out the phone numbers a couple of times. Our lines are all lit up, and I've been hogging you guys. Let's go to the phones. We've got Ann on the line.
Hello?
Ann, yes.
Yes. My question was, basically, I have two 86-year-old parents with dementia, one formerly diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and they are not aging in place in their homes. They are in an assisted living facility, one on the memory care unit, with, along with the staff aides and private aides we have hired. And I want to know, in a situation where you really cannot care for your parents in your home, how do you deal with the guilt you sometimes have, and other people say, well, why don't you take care of them at home, basically?
Lewis, you want to handle that?
Well, I would clearly say that the most important thing that you always have to keep in mind is safety, that everybody else can be opinionated about what you should do and where you should have them. But the reality of it is that so often a facility is the best place for your loved ones, when, especially when you're dealing with the dementia. And so, you know, I would just kind of not allow people to guilt trip you. You have to keep focus. It's the best care and the best place. The other thing I also realized, too, is so often people assume that once you place a loved one in a skilled nursing facility or assisted care facility, that the caregiving declines. And in fact, it doesn't decline at all. The same stress, the same burdens, the same everything is the same as if that loved one was in your home. So I think it is important that what you have done in terms of having them in a facility where they're cared for and that they're safe is so key.
Anne, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Okay. I think what Lewis said was great and might have cured your guilt, but let me suggest something else too. That often guilt is something that protects us from what we psychologists call existential helplessness. And that if we could peel away your guilt, we might find other emotions behind there. And that's just great sadness and helplessness. And I'm sure that you love your parents and just wish this wasn't happening and wish you could do something to protect them, to hold them, to make life easier for them. And those emotions are even more painful than the guilt.
I would agree with that. And hello?
Yes.
And what I found, too, what Lewis is saying was very, what you're saying is extremely helpful, both of you. What I have found is try not to be so alone in the whole process.
Yes. Yes. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I kind of started out, I immersed myself in their health care in January of 2008, and I'm one of six siblings, but I found that I was the one who, I don't know, you tell me if this is common, but I was the one not in denial, and the other five still thought my dad could still drive, so forth. And so I took and finally I realized last spring that I was burnt out, and I couldn't do it all. And even though they're in a facility, there was plenty to do. And so I finally said to my family, I can't do it, and I was surprised by the reaction of everybody, and everybody was, with the exception of one who lives close by to me, everybody was great about pitching in. I kind of just assumed nobody would want to pitch in, but they all, they all did.
I've got to tell you, it's very common to, have one sibling that does the heavy lifting. And it runs 50-50 about whether a sibling is there when you ask them to be there or not. And, many of these, quote, responsible siblings, close quote, have difficulty giving up control. Lewis just wrote me a note. Get into a support group. There are lots of support groups out there. So I do hope that's helpful. Pat, speaking of siblings, you have a sister, yes?
Yes.
Where was she in the process?
In fact, I could just respond very quickly to the caller. I would say that regret, doubt, and guilt are all part of the package when you're going through this. They are normal emotions.
Yeah, that's so true.
It's sprinkled throughout my book. There's regrets for things done, regrets for things not done, guilt, and it's part of just what you have to work through, but it's part of what makes it so hard, because there's no absolutes. There's no right way to do it, and there's no wrong way to do it. There's only the best way you can do it.
Yeah, I call regret the persistence of the impossible.
There were two girls. My parents had two daughters, and I moved them back. I moved my parents back from Florida to be near me so that they would be near one of us. My sister lived in another state quite a ways away, so she came when she could, but it's harder these days. Kids don't live right next door or right down the block or in the same town, so that's something we deal with too, with the out-of-town children who just can't get there as much.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Vivian on the line. Vivian, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, yes, I'm an aging parent. I'm still very active, but I think we need to bring in the aging parents to say what they would like. I was a caretaker partly for my mom when my sister was sick, got sick herself, and she was the one who lived closest. And my mom, I made the decision to have a pacemaker put in. She was comatose. And when she got up, she was 92 years old, she said to me, "Viv, you know, when it's time to go, it's time to go." And she had three difficult years and very difficult for me. And I don't think that it's always such a feeling of how great you what a great job you did. I think there's a tremendous relief after watching somebody deteriorate for such a long time.
That too.
And as a parent, I don't want my children to go through that. And I have talked with them. I've opened up the conversation a bit. And I told them I'd like my body to go to medical school, that I want to go to medical school when I die. And it was a laugh.
What do you want in terms of caregiving, Vivian?
I don't want them to have to feel that they have to do the care. And I don't want to get in a position where I would need, when my quality of life was so bad. I have actually joined Final Exit because I hope that I would be astute enough to recognize what was happening and be able to take care of it. I'd like them to visit me from time to time, but I don't want them to feel that they have to carry that guilt or that burden of care. But I think that the parents ought to talk to the kids.
I agree with you. I don't know if you can protect them from that guilt. I remember speaking with my aging aunt, and she was near death, and she said, "What can I do to protect my daughter so that she doesn't have to suffer from so much?" And I said, "That's easy." I said, "Just don't die." You know, but you know, if you're going through that process, you know your children are going to suffer, and you know, like Pat said, you know, guilt and regret, and I forget the other one of that
doubt,
triumvirate doubt. Yeah, that's going to happen. So you can't protect your children from that because they love you. But what you can do is just be clear about what you want. Not so much what you don't want, but what you do want. And that'll be very helpful for them. I really appreciate your weighing in. It's a perspective we need to have. Thanks so much for your call, Vivian, and I do wish you the best. Well, we're going to have to take another short break, and I want to talk more with my guests about, how we ultimately do say goodbye and what that means to us and what happens after goodbye. My guests are Pat Nugent and Lewis Colbert. Pat is author of They Live On, Saying Goodbye to Mom and Dad. Lewis is the director of the Delaware County Office of Services for the Aging. Our number is 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. Continuing education at PATHA has art classes and workshops this fall in drawing, painting, sculpture, printmaking, and more. Featuring Saturday classes for high school students, art appreciation in the PATHA Museum, and master classes with classical realist artist and author Juliet Aristides and noted painters Bill Scott and Stuart Shills. PATHA CE, a community of artists of all ages and levels. Classes begin September 8th. For details, pafa.edu/CE.
When Hurricane Katrina touched down and the levees broke, flooding New Orleans, many wondered how the city would survive.
When you really look at the story of New Orleans, the biggest part of it is how we do celebrate through adversity.
A conversation with jazz musician Irvin Mayfield and music writer Keith Spira, author of Groove Interrupted, is next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking with Patricia Nugent and Lewis Colbert about caring for aging parents and saying goodbye to them. Pat, as your father deteriorated, this stormy guy and this stormy relationship, tell us what happened to your relationship with him. You alluded to it earlier in the show, and I cut you off.
You know, he was a man that I tried very hard not to spend a lot of time with in our younger days, and then suddenly he needed me, and as it turns out, I needed him as well. It was a privilege and a burden to be there with him as we approached the end of his life, because my mom had a brain tumor, and at the same time that he was developing dementia, they were in two different facilities because based on the care that they needed. So I would run from one place to the other. And the time I spent with my dad, in many ways, it was so healing for both of us that he knew he was dependent. He became much more pleasant. He was so happy to see me, and I was genuinely happy to see him as well. And I can't exactly explain what made the difference, except all of a sudden we realized whatever had gone on before between us, whatever hurt there was no time for it anymore, and that we had to get down to our basic relationship, which was a relationship based on love, and forget what had happened.
Can I just make a suggestion about something else that also might have been going on?
Mm-hmm.
That once he became vulnerable and no longer threatening,
mm-hmm.
that you were able to be less defensive and maybe your heart opened spontaneously. That's what happens when we're in the presence of people who are vulnerable. Our hearts tend to open spontaneously.
I think that's an excellent assessment. He seemed bigger than life to me until there's this little man in a hospital bed who lights up when I walk in the room, and it changed everything. But I think your assessment is perfect.
Hmm.
Yes.
Let's go to the phones. Let's get Carla on. Hi, Carla.
Hi. Good morning. I have a really complicated situation in that I was very, very close to my dad, and I had a sister who wasn't as close, but, you know, we got along okay, and he basically raised us because our mother died when I was 13. And I have a problem in that she lived with him all her life. She never had children or anything, and she stayed at home. She was always kind of vulnerable. And I went out and got married and had children, and my father's really fond of the grandchildren and stuff. And when he became very ill, we could tell, you know, he had a couple of years, but she just got so overwhelmed with caring for him, and he was angry and lashing out, and I would come as often as I could. I lived 3 or 4 states away.
Mm.
And when we really got to the end, she was virtually mentally ill, and interfered with my being able to help him. I was in a much better position to bring him to my house where he had his grandchildren and where he'd be comfortable, and we were very close. And she just said, I can't let him go. You know, even though it would have been better for him. And she would complain all the time about the work, and I would try and come out and help. And she was so ill. I mean, the hardest thing that happened was really the last chance I had to see him about a week before he died. You know, we could still talk and laugh and everything. And I was on my way to drive home, and I said, she was convinced that I had somehow gotten him to change the will, when in fact I knew in advance that he was going to leave the house to her, and I was comfortable with that. And, you know, it was not a big deal. You know, I was in a better place, and she needed it, and she was convinced. And my last conversation with my father had to be, going to change the will, right? The will's the same. The house is going to my, you know, to Susie.
So what?
Okay.
What happened?
He said, yeah.
Carla, what happened? What happened?
Well,
how did, how did it turn out? I drove home,
and I came back a week later, and he was in a coma, and I never got a chance to speak to him again. And I've forgiven my sister because she ended up really sick. I mean, the point where people thought she was schizophrenic, and she was calling the FBI, and she was calling the fire department and saying her light bulbs were bugged, and she believed that we had put something in her body.
So what's happening now, Carla?
Well, my sister she's healed. It turned out she had post-traumatic stress, and she's still very, very vulnerable. And we went through a long and horrible period where she wouldn't speak to me, and you know, and she kept thinking everything was fraud. And
where are we now, Carla? Because I got one eye on the clock.
Okay, I got you. I've forgiven her completely. I understand what was going through, what she was going through, and her pain. And it was such an effort to try and get her help because the situation.
I've got to get you to the end of the story.
We live in different states. I had a wedding for my daughter, and she's my only living relative, and she couldn't come. She wouldn't come because she was too ashamed. She knew that I'd probably talk to my sister-in-laws and my friends. She couldn't face them.
Well,
so she's still very vulnerable.
You are addressing these very difficult sibling issues that come up, and Lewis is one of the lucky ones that his siblings all pitched in. Pat, unfortunately, was not. There was difficulty between her and her sister, and it's heartbreaking that this has to happen, and often planning in advance can really help the process.
It's like what, when I sit and I'm listening to you, Carla, I guess the question I'm asking myself is, what did you learn from it that you could pass on to your children? So as Dan talks about, you don't have that sibling rivalry passed on from generation to generation.
Oh, that's such an important point. Pat, you wanted to say something?
Yes, I from doing the readings and the talks I've been doing, I have found that sibling issues are so common when parents become vulnerable, and parents kind of are the placekeeper for power in a family. And even if they're old, they still are the placeholder. And when a void is created by a parent being drawn out of that, siblings jump in to fill the void, and it's often in a dysfunctional kind of way. So what I've come to realize is that, that siblings are often at odds, and hopefully the healing can come afterward, but it's not uncommon for siblings to have a difference of opinion or approach in how to deal with it.
I want to shift gears here a minute, Pat. Tell us how your father died. Was it peaceful?
No, I would say it was not. We made the decision that he had pneumonia, and we made the decision to try another intervention and took him to the hospital rather than just letting him die from pneumonia. So he had a rough couple of days, but then we accepted it, and hospice came in, and the last 24 hours or so was peaceful, and my sister and I were both there.
You were with him.
We were with him. My mom's was very peaceful because we let her be in the setting she was in. We didn't go for the heroic intervention at the end. We knew we had reached the end of the line. And those decisions are very hard, whether you give it one more shot and see what you can do or whether you let them go. And that's where the regret, the doubt, and the guilt just kind of culminate.
Yeah, I hear it. I hear it. Lewis, I remember when my dad died, I remember thinking in the back of my mind, maybe that's the way I'll die. Maybe I will die this way. And he died beautifully. I mean, he knew he was dying, and He was an atheist, and he was fine with all of that stuff. And you know, it's dying time, and he was kind, and he was sad that I had to suffer. Mm-hmm. Did you have any of those feelings about your mother? Did you wonder about your death?
Well, my mother, as I said, who suffered from Parkinson's and diabetes and the Alzheimer's, it was a long, drawn-out process. And we witnessed a woman who was mentally alert decline to the point that in a given week she might have maybe 30 seconds of clarity, that she knew who you were and you had those glimpses of her personality. And so I think she had gotten to the point where I think she was ready to go. I think all of us around her knew very clearly that, you know, the end was coming towards. In the medical profession, I must admit, the palliative care team was very helpful in terms of, I thought, preparing the siblings and the grandchildren.
Hmm. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time for our discussion, but I do want to introduce another element to our show. There's so many things to miss when your parents are no longer with us. Their voice, their devotion, the ability to call up and chat. The connection to the older generation. Well, WHYY's producer Alexis Landis produced her longing for her mother in this essay, which first aired as part of WHYY's This I Believe series.
The other day I realized that I have my mother's hands, lines creasing the skin, olive tone, round fingernails. I never thought we looked anything alike, but as I slowly age, I see more and more of her in me. The way my body is shaped, the clothes I choose to wear, the things I like and dislike, the passion I bring to everything I do. My mother passed away on a cold December day in 2009 after complications from a brain aneurysm and stroke that had left her debilitated. I struggled with her death alone and inside of myself, desperately wanting to return to a normal life. But I knew my perception of the world around me would be changed forever. I ended up seeing a therapist and doing a lot of writing, but nothing could replace the conversations we used to have about life, good food, my husband, or the frivolous joys of clothing and makeup, and, of course, politics. That was the greatest thing about my mom. She was smart and elegant, but also down to earth and funny. But more importantly, she taught me to uphold intellectual pursuit and wit above all else, to always face down opposition with grace, and to view the world around me from all sides. Her enthusiasm, work ethic, and determination pushed me to nurture my work in television and radio. And whether I succeeded or struggled, she was always there to share in the moment. I wouldn't go more than a few days without talking to her. She was always happy to hear from me no matter what, her voice radiating tenderness and love, like a warm blanket wrapped around you in the middle of winter. Sometimes I make a mental check to make sure I still remember that voice, just as it was. I can still hear her motherly mantra. "Don't worry about me," she would say. "You come first." I'm still not sure if I like the way she always put herself second. I do know I won't get to talk to her again in the same way I used to, but we will forever be entwined. When I miss her, all I have to do is look at my hands.
That was a very poignant and powerful essay that was written by our own Alexis Landis, a WHYY producer here at WHYY. Pat, in what ways are you a changed person after having this experience?
Oh, I'm changed in so many ways, and I wasn't expecting it. I went from being a school administrator before my parents got sick to being somebody who's produced a book that has been called The Crying Catalyst. I am doing readings and talking to people who are dealing with their long-term residual guilt or residual sadness over being parentless. So I'm almost on a ministry to help other people, to help the journey not be so lonely for other people. It's it's become my primary focus.
Isn't that wonderful? Lewis, you talk about what have you learned from this experience. So, right back at you.
I clearly believe that I am a stronger and a more prepared advocate. I think that there is such a tremendous need for our country to become much more culturally sensitive to end-of-life issues, as well as caregiver issues. And so as I go through the experience, I love talking to people about seizing the opportunity. It's nothing to run from. It's something to embrace. But clearly I know that I'm a better advocate for end-of-life issues.
Well, you say it's nothing to run from. It's also pretty terrifying. In a deep-down way, you know, we all try to
Absolutely.
Run from it for most of our life.
Absolutely.
And, you know, as Pat said so eloquently in her book about, you know, the great suffering that goes with the process and the great gift. It really is mm-hmm. it is a complex and painful treasure. Well, I want to thank you both so much for joining us. It's been a rich and powerful show, and I want to thank you both for your stories.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lewis Colbert is director of the Delaware County Office of Services for the Aging. Pat Nugent is the author of They Live On, Saying Goodbye to Mom and Dad. Hey, listen, she's going to be reading at Robin's Books in Center City, entitled The Sun After the Storm, Finding Your Way After Loss. That's going to be on September 18th at 4 p.m. September 18th at 4 p.m. at Robin's Bookstore. Next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to be preempted by a special program about trauma and recovery produced by Mike and Scott. It's called Out of the Shadows. Well, if you want to reach us, we're at voices@whyy.org. And me, I'm at drdangottlieb.com. The engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer for audio content. Our intern is Emily Haas. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. Oh, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friend.